Welcome to Alaska Edition, a weekly public affairs program produced by Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated in the studios of KAKM. The host and moderator for Alaska Edition is Michael Carey.
Thank you for joining us. Our guests are Paul Jenkins, the Anchorage Daily Planet, and Steve McDonald of Channel 2 News. Paul, lawmakers' travel and per diem expenses make the front page. When the legislature is not meeting, this is a hardy perennial, what they spent during the interim. This year, Senate Finance Chair, Co-Chair Bert Stedman made the headline in particular with his trip to Hawaii. Tell us about the travel story and Senator Stedman.
Well, about a quarter of the legislature, more than a dozen lawmakers, went to Hawaii, that place where it's so tough to live. Mm-hmm. And for a convention, what kind of a convention, I'm not sure what it is, it helps government be better government or something. And while they were there, they stayed at a resort hotel, and he had hoped, Senator Stedman, co-chairman of the Senate Finance Committee, had hoped that his room, normally what he thought was a $695 a night room, measly little thing, that he would have it increased, that his staff, he asked his staff to get it, see if he could get it bumped up, complimentary kind of upgrade. They assured him, oh, you're in there. And then the next thing you know, my golly, when he was looking at the bill at the end of the thing, oh no, it all, when you added all the goodies in, it was like over $900. Well, he had
a night.
And he had a very pithy response to that, which I'm not going to go into here, but it expressed, imagine his surprise. And so that's where it was. The media's made a big deal of it, of course. I've made a big deal of it. Everybody's made a big deal of it. And he says, no, this was a mistake. He kind of said, my staff misled me, words to that effect. And that's where we are right now. The public, of course, again, is wondering what exactly is it these guys are doing. So that's pretty much where it stands.
Steve, are voters going to buy this explanation that is a combination of I really didn't understand what was going on. The staff made a mistake. Mm-hmm. I was misled. I had somebody call me up and say, listen, this is the chairman of the finance committee and he can't even read a hotel bill. What's going on here?
That makes you worry, right? He's going through billions of dollars of state revenues and he's in charge of all of this. And then he gets tripped up by the hotel bill. That is a little worrisome. You know, he's blaming it on a staff, kind of an oversight, like Paul said. Does this make or break a legislator? I mean, no, hopefully it won't. You go on the full picture of his of actions and votes and things like that. But yeah, it's pretty poor judgment on this. Even at $600 a night or whatever he thought it was going to be, it's still pretty
tax
pricey.
It's formidable at $600 a night, let alone nine.
Yeah, this is a touchy subject with any legislator who goes out of town for training. And is it necessary? Yeah, oh yeah, I think lawmakers should travel. They need to see what goes on outside. They should get out of their ideas. It will make them a better legislator, hopefully. But at the same time, this is a highly sensitive issue. It's a highly charged issue, and people are already cynical about lawmakers spending money. This is coming off of a legislative special session that judged as a waste of time and a waste of money.
Steve, I might. It had three magic words in it: Hawaii, 5,000,
yeah,
and legislator.
Yeah. You know, why not Bismarck? Why not December?
And why not Minot?
Why not Fargo?
Yeah, right. I mean, come on. Yeah.
Steve, almost 25% of the legislature went to this Hawaiian conference,
yeah,
between 20 and 25%, and certainly the public's going to notice that, too.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely. Now, could you go back and say, okay, look, we can't have everybody going out there and spending money and spending going to Hawaii on the state's dime, so we're going to take a Democrat, we're going to take a Republican, we're going to send you two people there, and then you're going to come back and present all the material to the rest of us, so we can all enjoy this kind of education and hopefully prosper from it. So, I can understand why you want to go, but again, if this was in Fargo, would we have that many people going off to this thing? It's Hawaii.
Paul, the public is mad now. They have the idea that the legislators got a special break, went to a special place, walked around with lampshades on their head. This is the kind of thing that,
you got those people will
bring up. At the same time, I don't recall a legislator who's ever been defeated because of travel per diem questions. And so you have to wonder if it's just something of a tempest in a teapot.
I think with the national economy in the tank and Alaska's economy having sidestepped much of it but starting to feel the pain, I think people are paying more attention to this sort of thing now. $710,000 last year they spent on travel. That's hard to justify. We're told, no, by golly, if you're a state employee, we don't want you going anywhere. We'll do teleconferences. Right. So you can tie up your afternoon trying to hear what this guy in Sitka and that guy in Barrow are trying to say, but you can't. It's difficult, it's unwieldy, but that's what they're expected to do. A guy with a business, the same thing. He can't afford to put people on a plane and send them somewhere for training. So people are starting to, I think, pay more attention to it. And I think in the near future, I think right around the corner, people are going to start getting more than just a little angry about it.
People are tightening their belts. People are worried out there. Then you see this. The perception's not good, obviously.
You know, most of Alaska, I'll wager, if you take out oil industry jobs, which the Democrats are trying to do,
that's another topic.
Exactly. Most Alaskans, $6.95 a week would be a fair salary for a lot of people. Right. And for one night in a hotel in Hawaii, a resort, I don't know.
Okay, thank you. Senator Lisa Murkowski issues a warning that it's at the top of the front page and leads television news in the evening. She's concerned about the future of federal spending in Alaska, and she gave a speech at Commonwealth North where she developed that. Paul, tell us about Senator Murkowski's speech to Commonwealth North.
Well, what she pretty much said was the party's just about over. I think Senator Stevens came here several times and said the same thing. All right. Highway of construction funding, defense construction funding, rural health care. All of these things, she said, are in jeopardy in the future, at least pieces of them, because the federal budget has to shrink. It can't continue along the size that it is. The Budget Control Act, where it set up this super committee in Washington of 12 senators to go out and 12 lawmakers to go out and cut $1.5 billion from the national budget, trillion. By at the end of November. Barring that failure to do that, $1.2 trillion will be cut automatically, half of it from defense, which nobody really wants to see, and half of it from non-defense.
And if I understand the stories correctly from public radio, New York Times, and so forth, there's already jockeying among the services who's going to have to take it.
If nothing happens and it goes to the automatic cuts, nothing is sacred. We're talking Social Security, Medicare, all of that's involved. So they're trying to figure out how to do this ahead of time. They want to cut $970 billion by the end of November, just to get this thing started. Mm-hmm. It's a serious message. I think Alaskans are going to have to get used to the idea that we're going to have to get less from the federal government. And in many areas, we get more than most people. Huh. But as we've always argued, Alaska is unique in infrastructure here mm-hmm. as a party everywhere else. So.
Steve, the message has been anticipated. As you said, you alluded to Senator Stevens earlier. A couple of years ago, he was talking about these kind of things.
Right.
But the messenger is what's important here. Who delivered this message? A mm-hmm. sitting senator, our senior U.S. senator. And the clear implication was there's not a whole lot the messenger can do about this.
No, it's not. It's, you know, this is a national issue. This is a national constituency that's involved right now, everybody in the country, and it's going to be hard to keep Alaska out of the sights of the people who are going to try and hack the budget. Everybody's a target here. Everything's on the table, and yeah, it's a very, very stern warning from a very sobering message from Senator Murkowski about this. As Paul said, military, big part of our economy. Health services, another big part of our economy and a necessity for folks living out in the villages and in rural areas like that. And it's all up for reduction, possible reduction on this.
Okay, thank you very much. Once again, I'm Michael Carey. I'm here with Paul Jenkins and Steve McDonald. Paul, consultants peg the toll for the Kinnick Arm crossing the bridge at $5 a trip and rising 2% annually. We were also told that the state of Alaska, and this has been bandied about for quite a while now, will need to put up $150 million if this bridge is to be completed. How does this information affect the future of the bridge?
Well, this $150 million is to cover, I guess, shortfalls in the first few years for tolls, for the four people who have to drive back and forth 24 hours a day to make the thing pay. But they don't, there's great debate over whose surveys are correct, which census data is correct, how many cars are going to, 36,000 trips a day, 14 trips a day, somewhere in there, we're not sure. So there's likely to be a shortfall in the first few years on tolls. That $150 million is to help with that. I think it throws another stone in the machinery. There's going to be a huge fight about another $150 million. And it's not even a hard number. It's just one of those numbers that, it may cover the loss, it may not.
This is one thing that drives legislators crazy. First of all, it's a lot of money. And second, can you assure me that you won't be back here next year?
No, they can't. And I think that's the problem.
Steve, how far are we? Far away are we from the magic day when we will know if there is going to be a bridge?
I think Paul's right. I think this information kind of means two step backwards, perhaps. We're still a long ways away. They haven't chosen a contractor. There's still legislation that was introduced by Senator Menard last legislative session that wasn't acted upon, and perhaps it'll get before lawmakers in the upcoming legislative session here in 2012. That would create this $150 million mechanism, this pool of money that would cover any shortfalls. We're still a long ways away from any major developments in this bridge. And I think this information now is just going to cause people to look even closer and scrutinize the project even more so, because there is no guarantee that that's all you're going to need is $150 million and that's going to be it. Are there enough people living on the other side of Kinnick Arm that are going to travel over into Anchorage to pay this thing off? I don't think there are enough right now.
On the other hand, there's some very influential people who are committed to the bridge.
Sure. Oh, there certainly are. Yeah. But you're going to have to. There's going to have to be a buildup of homes on the other side. That's going to take a while. Yeah, that's going to take a while to do that, to have a sufficient enough population coming back and forth, commuting to Anchorage, to help pay off that bridge. And or either that, or we're all going to have to commit to going fishing and hiking up there.
And there's
it's pretty good.
Yeah.
Still a lot. I'm all for it.
Yeah.
There's a lot of things still unfinished. City of Anchorage has sued. It's hauled this thing into court to stop.
That's the question, though. The entrance and exit.
Where it's going to hit the port. Yeah.
Yeah.
Little things like that haven't been even ironed out yet.
Same thing with Government Hill. There's a small community up there
that
feels it's going to be overrun by traffic coming off the bridge. A lot of questions to answer just yet, and this is another one.
Okay. Wasilla City Councilman Steve Menard apparently thought he was a rock star. He was in Sitka and he trashed a hotel room. He was on city business. Steve, this is a very odd story. What can you tell us about it?
Well, Mr. Menard, Councilman Menard, was down there attending a government workshop. He should have gone to Hawaii. He just should have gone over there. This was a city kind of workshop. According to reports, he trashed his hotel room, did some pretty bad things to the linens and the mattresses and small fires and all kinds of things. Now the city's been billed for $350. The hotel says really should have been more. City's got to pay for it. He was the subject of an executive session meeting on, I think it was Monday night. He's not allowed to travel anymore during the remainder of his term in office. He issued an apology, public apology. I believe again it was the beginning of the week here. So it's a shame. The Menards are a well-known family up in the Matsu Valley. Of course, Senator Menard, Lisa Menard, his father Kurt have done a lot of good things for, and Steve Menard's done some good things for his community as well. So this is a real black eye for not only the family, his friends, but the community as well.
Paul, I was in a hotel in Madison, Wisconsin, and the people there bragged at the hotel that Van Halen had trashed one of their presidential suite and wasn't allowed to stay there anymore. So I guess, I don't know if that's true for Van Halen, if you were here, would have something to say about that. But the point is that it seems like if you're a big enough celebrity, it's a story. If you're if you're a small-time celebrity, they send you the bill and tell you, don't come back.
Don't come back. You can't travel on our dime. We don't like you anymore.
Paul, I wanted to ask you, somehow I have in the back of my head our old colleague and friend Terry Carr, the veteran journalist, phrase, alcohol may have been involved. What do you think?
Well, I don't think there's any doubt about it. I think even he admits that. At the end of all of this mess, he apologized and he said, 11 days sober and yeah. On with his life, and I wish him the best. I do. It's a terrible affliction to have to keep coming back from. But this story is at the same time in juxtaposition with all these legislators going to Hawaii. It's just a hoot. I'm sorry. This guy really, he destroyed his career, I think, pretty mm-hmm. much, his political career. And his political career was burgeoning. I mean, he has several appointments to
well, what it makes you wonder.
Impressive credentials, for God's sake.
Paul, I interrupted you. You'll forgive me. But what I was going to say was, what it makes you wonder if we just have a shortage of grown-ups around here. I mean,
we got a lot of booze.
They're all grounded. It's webinars from now on for everybody.
Everybody goes on the web. That's
okay. I'll have the Perrier, please. Legislators and the whole city council.
Thank you, Paul.
The state and ExxonMobil look like they're on the verge of settling their dispute over Point Thompson. Please tell us what that dispute involved and why the settlement of the dispute among the players involved and then with the state could be of importance.
If this is settled, it'll be huge. The Point Thompson field discovered in 77 is a very highly problematic field to develop. It's high pressure. There's a couple hundred million barrels of oil there. There's a quarter of the 35 trillion cubic feet of gas that the North Slope is expected to hold is on this field. It's in this field. It's a prickly field to try to develop. And on the one hand, Exxon will say, since we've gotten this field, we have tried very hard to develop, but we have problems. We've spent hundreds of millions of dollars up there trying to delineate the field and figure out how to develop it. Besides that, we don't have anywhere to send the gas. We don't have anywhere to send the oil. We're in a position up here where we can do this, but what are we going to do with the product? What you wind up with then, though, is the state, and under Senator Murkowski, or Governor Murkowski's administration, saying, well, it's been so long. It's been too long. You have not developed this field. We've signed off on your development plans every year. And you haven't done it. And move to tear apart that district where those were and take back the land. Anyway, this whole thing evolves and there's the courts fights here and administrative fights here, and it's in the Supreme Court at this point. But if these guys can work this out and get Point Thompson where it'll actually produce, where they can actually produce at Point Thompson, we're not gonna ever have a gas line in this state probably without Point Thompson. Because we need that
gas. They need
the gas. They need the gas. And if they can get that going, get something working up there with them, I think that opens up a whole new future for gas off of that field and other fields up there as well.
Okay. Thank you very much. Steve, when are we going to know more, considering that so much of this is confidential?
Yeah, I don't know if we'll ever hear the final deal. I don't know if it's going to be kept confidential because of business plans or marketing plans, whatever, for Exxon. I don't proprietary information. I don't know if that'll ever be made public. Now it's involving the states, so you would think it is public. So you would think that we would hear something about the final deal, but maybe we won't hear all the details. But I think we'll be told, hey, we got a deal and we're going to go do this now and it won't be before the Supreme Court anymore. And like Paul says, if they can avoid going to court, that's the best for both sides if they can strike a good deal.
And I think everybody involved would like to be able to come up forward with some talking points to say,
yeah,
this is why this is what we can tell you, and this is why it all matters.
Yeah, I think that that's probably what we'll hear. We won't hear all of the details, but I think what everybody does want to hear is that that Exxon has found terms favorable to it, that it can go ahead and produce this field, and the state has gotten terms favorable to it, that it's going to receive the royalties, and then it's also going to have assurances that this field is finally going to be developed. And it is the linchpin, many say, to getting a natural gas pipeline built.
Right, right. And that's been a lot of the discussion at these public hearings that I attended and others of us attended. Steve, let's stick with you. Cab driver Norman Nowarki is arrested for rape. He was released on $5,000 bail, which many people who follow the criminal justice system, especially those who were advocates for rape victims, think is far too low for the nature of the crime.
Yeah.
Tell us more about this case and about the firestorm that erupted over bail.
There is a lot to this case, an awful lot, and an awful lot that people aren't willing to say publicly. We've been told off the record by investigators that they're very unhappy with the fact that this bail was set at such a low amount. There's a bail bondsman, great quote in the Anchorage Daily News, where a bail bondsman said, oh no, these normally go for many times higher than what was given to this fella. So there were a lot of folks who were very upset about what was considered the low level of bail that was asked for. Now, that's one aspect of it. Police felt that, you know, there may be more to that. There may be more than one victim. They have received information from other women now who have stepped forward and said, "Yeah, I'm a victim as well of this fellas." One of the things that we had gotten an audio recording of the bail hearing, if you will, when the judge set the bail. Another judge interceded and said, "No, we're sealing that." So, you know, we don't want to jeopardize an investigation here. We don't want to be responsible for that. So we adhered to what was to the judge's order, and we didn't release details. But on that, I can tell you this: on that tape, there are some there's some information that the investigators definitely want withheld, because it's going to help them decide whether or not a woman who comes forth and says, "I'm a victim," it's going to help them decide if she's telling the truth or not. So there's some evidence on that DVD or CD, I should say. So it's an all-encompassing case. There's a lot of details, a lot of moving parts right now in this whole
Paul,
thing.
Paul, I assume a judge, or in this case a magistrate, or a judge beyond the magistrate, could decide to raise the bail.
Well, it's even more than that. When they issued this $5,000 bail, there was no third-party custodian. Mm-hmm. The judge raised no objection, him going right back to the job that he had. All of this is unusual. I mean, in my old days of covering courts, I never saw anything like this happen. As information comes forward, the information that Steve is talking about, a prosecutor can go back into court and petition and tell a judge, this guy may be a public threat to public safety, and they can, in fact, raise the bail. They can raise the bail and bond on these things, you bet.
Yeah. I was going to note that I have worked on the history of bail. It's a very interesting subject, and bail is very old. It goes all the way back to the controversies of the Revolution, when our founding fathers felt that people should be allowed to leave jail to defend their case, and that's been throughout our history, although not all crimes in all states or the federal system are open to bail, even very high figures of bail. Most of the history of bail has involved officials setting bail so high that people couldn't get out. Mm-hmm. And it's really been since the 1950s that the United States Supreme Court said that a bail has to be commensurate with the offense. Mm-hmm. That is to say, you couldn't offer somebody bail of $50,000 for a jaywalking offense if that's all it was, if they could find some way to get you in jail for jaywalking. The other thing is, bail could not be used for ulterior purposes. I mean, it's well known, if you look in the history of the criminal justice system, there was a period in American history when police officers and judges, if they wanted to keep a witness around, mm-hmm. They would put him in jail with very high, keep him in bail with very high bail so he couldn't leave. Mm-hmm. And bail is supposed to give you the opportunity to defend your case and prepare for your case. So those are some of the major requirements and a very interesting history.
One more thing to point out about this case, too, is, and just by way of context, it's been reported that the judge who's involved, who heard the motions for bail and things and decided the bail, at least, he's basically experienced more so in civil law, and I think he's just been appointed to this magistrate position, and he doesn't have a lot of experience, it appears, in criminal law. So I don't know if this has a bearing on his decision or what, a lack of experience. I'm not sure, but he hasn't been doing this for a whole
We got about 1 minute left, and I want to ask Paul about the big earthquake that had east coast of the United States all shook up. Many Alaskans were sort of laughing at people running out of buildings in Washington, but if you have been in an earthquake before, it's a scary thing.
It's a scary thing, and I my heart goes out to him. There's that, right. That you're sure you're a goner. You know, it's going to be not only a goner, but it's going to be terrible when it happens.
The phrase, the big one.
The big one. But you know, as time goes on from this thing, we start to see that there's some serious damage there. That right. We've got cracks in the Washington Monument and statues toppled and broken, and buildings and I think it was probably more serious than we first. Gave thought to, but it's funny to watch him.
We're going to get out of here. I'm just going to mention real quickly that Clyde Haberman, the columnist for the New York Times, had a great line. He said, in New York, earthquakes are as rare as Met victories in the World Series. Thank you very much for joining us here on Alaska Edition. We'll see you next week, right before Labor Day.
If you have questions or comments about the program, you can email Alaska Edition at alaskaedition@alaskapublic.org or write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508. Alaska Edition is a production of KAKM. The opinions expressed are those of the host and guests and do not necessarily represent those of KSKA, KAKM, the licensee, or their underwriters.